capturing people's attention and keeping it inside a safe zone. For instance, when explaining that the world rests on the back of a huge elephant, you should preempt any difficult questions by describing in great detail the way that the flapping of the elephant's gigantic ears causes hurricanes, and how, when the elephant quivers with anger, earthquakes shake the surface of the earth. If you weave a good enough yarn, it won't occur to anyone to ask what the elephant is standing on. Similarly, nationalism enchants us with tales of heroism, moves us to tears by recounting past disasters, and ignites our fury by dwelling on the injustices our nation suffered. We get so absorbed in this national epic that we start evaluating everything that happens in the world by its impact on our nation, and hardly think of asking what makes our nation so important in the first place. When you believe a particular story, it makes you extremely interested in its minutest details, while keeping you blind to anything that falls outside its scope. Devout communists may spend countless hours debating whether it is permissible to make an alliance with social democrats in the early stages of revolution, but they seldom stop to ponder the place of the proletariat in the evolution of mammalian life on planet Earth, or in the spread of organic life in the cosmos. Such idle talk is considered a counter-revolutionary waste of breath. Though some stories go to the trouble of encompassing the entirety of space and time, the ability to control attention allows many other successful stories to remain far more modest in scope. A crucial law of storytelling is that once a story manages to extend beyond the audience's horizon, its ultimate scope matters little. People may display the same murderous fanaticism for the sake of a thousand-year-old nation as for the sake of a billion-year-old god. People are just not good with large numbers. In most cases, it takes surprisingly little to exhaust our imagination. Given everything we know about the universe, it would seem utterly impossible for any sane person to believe that the ultimate truth about the universe and human existence is the story of Israeli, German, or Russian nationalism, or indeed of nationalism in general. A story that ignores almost the whole of time, the whole of space, the Big Bang, quantum physics, and the evolution of life is at most just a tiny part of the truth. Yet people somehow manage not to see beyond it. Indeed, billions of people throughout history believed that for their lives to have meaning, they didn't even need to be absorbed into a nation or a great ideological movement. It was enough for them to just leave something behind, thereby ensuring that their personal story would continue beyond their death. The something I leave behind is ideally my soul or my personal essence. If I am reborn in a new body after the death of my present body, then death is not the end. It is merely the space between two chapters, and the plot that began in one chapter will carry on into the next. Many people have at least a vague faith in such a theory, even if they do not base it on any specific theology. They don't need an elaborate dogma. They just need the reassuring feeling that their story will continue beyond the horizon of death. This theory of life as a never-ending epic is extremely attractive and common, but it suffers from two main problems. First, by lengthening my personal story, I don't really make it more meaningful. I just make it longer. Indeed, the two great religions that embrace the idea of a never-ending cycle of births and deaths, Hinduism and Buddhism, share a horror of the futility of it all. Millions upon millions of times I learn how to walk, I grow up, I fight with my mother-in-law, I get sick, I die, and then I do it all over again. What's the point? If I could accumulate all the tears I have shed in all my previous lives, they would fill the Pacific Ocean. If I gathered together all the teeth and hair I have lost, they would make a mound higher than the Himalayas. And what do I have to show for all that? No wonder that Hindu and Buddhist sages have focused much of their efforts on finding a way to get off this merry-go-round, rather than to perpetuate it. The second problem with this theory is the paucity of supporting evidence. What proof do I have that in a past life I was a medieval peasant, a Neanderthal hunter, a Tyrannosaurus rex, or an amoeba? If I really lived millions of lives, I must have been a dinosaur and an amoeba at some point, for humans have existed for only the last 2.5 million years. And in the future, will I be reborn as a cyborg, an intergalactic explorer, or even a frog? Basing my life on this promise is a bit like selling my house in exchange for a post-dated check drawn on a bank above the clouds. People who doubt that some kind of soul or spirit really survives their death therefore strive to leave behind something a bit more tangible. That something tangible could take one of two forms, cultural or biological. I might leave behind a poem, say, or some of my precious genes. My life has meaning because people will still read my poem 100 years from now, or because my kids and grandchildren will still be around. And what is the meaning of their lives? Well, that's their problem, not mine. The meaning of life is thus a bit like playing with a live hand grenade. Once you pass it on to somebody else, you are safe. Alas, this modest hope of leaving something behind is rarely fulfilled. Most organisms that ever existed became extinct without leaving any genetic inheritance. Almost all the dinosaurs, for example. Or a Neanderthal family that became extinct as Homo sapiens took over. Or my grandmother's Polish clan. In 1934, my grandma Fanny immigrated to Jerusalem with her parents and two sisters. But most of their relatives stayed behind in the Polish towns of Chmielnik and Częstochowa. A few years later, the Nazis came along and wiped them out to the very last child. Attempts at leaving behind some cultural legacy are seldom more successful. Nothing has remained of my grandmother's Polish clan, except for a few faded faces in the family album, and at the age of 96, even my grandmother cannot match names to the faces any longer. To the best of my knowledge, they haven't left behind any cultural creation. Not a poem, not a diary, not even a grocery list. You might argue that they have a share in the collective inheritance of the Jewish people, or of the Zionist movement, but that hardly gives meaning to their individual lives. Moreover, how do you know that all of them cherished their Jewish identity, or agreed with the Zionist movement? Maybe one of them was a committed communist, and sacrificed his life spying for the Soviets. Maybe another wanted nothing more than to assimilate into Polish society, served as an officer in the Polish army, and was killed by the Soviets in the Katyn massacre. Maybe a third was a radical feminist, rejecting all traditional religious and nationalist identities. Since they left nothing behind, it is all too easy to recruit them posthumously to this or that cause, and they cannot even protest. If we cannot leave something tangible behind, such as a gene or a poem, might it be enough if we just make the world a little better? You can help somebody, and that somebody will subsequently help somebody else, and you thereby contribute to the overall improvement of the world, and constitute a small link in the great chain of kindness. Maybe you serve as a mentor for a difficult but brilliant child who goes on to be a doctor who saves the lives of hundreds. Maybe you help an old lady cross the street, brightening up an hour of her life. Though it has its merits, the great chain of kindness is a bit like the great chain of turtles. It is far from clear where its meaning comes from. A wise old man was asked what he learned about the meaning of life. "Well," he answered, "I have learned that I am here on earth in order to help other people. What I still haven't figured out is why the other people are here." For those who don't trust great chains, future legacies, or collective epics, perhaps the safest and most parsimonious story they can turn to is romance. It doesn't seek to go beyond the here and now. As countless love poems testify, when you are in love, the entire universe is reduced to the earlobe, the eyelash, or the nipple of your beloved. When gazing at Juliet leaning her cheek upon her hand, Romeo exclaims, "Oh, that I were a glove upon that hand, that I might touch that cheek." By connecting with a single body here and now, you feel connected with the entire cosmos. In truth, your beloved is just another human being, no different in essence from the multitudes you ignore every day on the train and in the supermarket. But to you, he or she seems infinite, and you are happy to lose yourself in that infinity. Mystic poets of all traditions have often conflated romantic love with cosmic union, writing about God as a lover. Romantic poets have repaid the compliment by writing about their lovers as gods. If you are really in love with someone, you never worry about the meaning of life. And what if you are not in love? Well, if you believe in the romantic story but you are not in love, you at least know what the aim of your life is, to find true love. You have seen it in countless movies and read about it in innumerable books. You know that one day you will meet that special someone. You will see infinity inside two sparkling eyes. Your entire life will suddenly make sense, and all the questions you ever had will be answered by repeating one name over and over again, just like Tony in West Side Story or Romeo upon seeing Juliet looking down at him from the balcony. The Weight of the Roof. While a good story must give me a role and must extend beyond my horizons, it need not be true. A story can be pure fiction, yet provide me with an identity and make me feel that my life has meaning. To the best of our scientific understanding, none of the thousands of stories that different cultures, religions, and tribes have invented throughout history is true. They are all just human inventions. If you ask for the true meaning of life and get a story in reply, know that this is the wrong answer. The exact details don't really matter. Any story is wrong, simply for being a story. The universe just does not work like a story. So why do people believe in these fictions? One reason is that their personal identity is built on the story. People are taught to believe in the story from early childhood. They hear it from their parents, their teachers, their neighbors, and the general culture long before they develop the intellectual and emotional independence necessary to question and verify such stories. By the time their intellect matures, they are so heavily invested in the story that they are far more likely to use their intellect to rationalize it than to doubt it. Most people who go on identity quests are like children going on a treasure hunt. They find only what their parents have hidden for them in advance. Second, not only are our personal identities built on the story, but so are our collective institutions. Consequently, it is extremely frightening to doubt the story. In many societies, anyone who tries to do so is ostracized or persecuted. Even if not, it takes strong nerves to question the very fabric of society. For if indeed the story is false, then the entire world as we know it makes no sense. State laws, social norms, economic institutions, they might all collapse. Most stories are held together by the weight of their roof rather than by the strength of their foundations. Consider the Christian story. It has the flimsiest of foundations. What evidence do we have that the Son of the Creator of the entire universe was born as a carbon-based life form somewhere in the Milky Way about 2,000 years ago? What evidence do we have that it happened in the Galilee area and that his mother was a virgin? Yet enormous global institutions have been built on top of that story, and their weight presses down with such overwhelming force that they keep the story in place. Entire wars have been waged over changing a single word of the story. The 1,000-year schism between Western Christians and Eastern Orthodox Christians, which has manifested itself recently in the mutual butchery of Croats by Serbs and Serbs by Croats, began over the loan word filioque, and from the son in Latin. The Western Christians wanted to insert this word into the Christian profession of faith, while the Eastern Christians vehemently objected. The theological implications of adding that word are so arcane that it would be impossible to explain them here in any meaningful way. If you are curious, ask Google. Once personal identities and entire social systems are built on top of a story, it becomes unthinkable to doubt it, not because of the evidence supporting it, but because its collapse will trigger a personal and social cataclysm. In history, the roof is sometimes more important than the foundations. Hocus Pocus and the Industry of Belief. The stories that provide us with meaning and identity are all fictional, but humans need to believe in them. It's obvious why humans want to believe the story, but how do they actually believe? How do we make the story feel real? Priests and shamans discovered the answer to this question thousands of years ago. Rituals. A ritual is a magical act that makes the abstract concrete and the fictional real. The essence of ritual is the magical spell. Hocus pocus, X is Y. How to make Christ real to his devotees? In the ceremony of Mass, the priest takes a piece of bread and a glass of wine and proclaims that the bread is Christ's flesh, the wine is Christ's blood, and by eating and drinking them, the faithful attain communion with Christ. What could be more real than actually tasting Christ in your mouth? Traditionally, the priest made these bold proclamations in Latin, the ancient language of religion, law, and the secrets of life. In front of the amazed eyes of the assembled peasants, the priest held high a piece of bread and exclaimed, "Hoc est corpus," this is the body, and the bread supposedly became the flesh of Christ. In the minds of the illiterate peasants who did not speak Latin, "Hoc est corpus" got garbled into "hocus pocus." Thus was born the powerful spell that can transform a frog into a prince and a pumpkin into a carriage. 1,000 years before the birth of Christianity, the ancient Hindus used the same trick. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad interprets the ritual sacrifice of a horse as a realization of the entire story of the cosmos. The text follows the hocus pocus, X is Y structure. The head of the sacrificial horse is the dawn, its eye the sun, its vital force the air, its open mouth the fire called Vaisvanara, and the body of the sacrificial horse is the year. Its members are the seasons, its joints the months and fortnights, its feet the days and nights, its bones the stars, and its flesh the clouds. Its yawning is lightning, its shaking the body is thundering, its making water is raining, and its neighing is voice. Almost anything can be turned into a ritual by imbuing deep religious meaning in mundane gestures such as lighting candles, ringing bells, or counting beads. The same is true of physical gestures, such as bowing the head, prostrating the whole body, or bringing both palms together. Various forms of headgear, from the Sikh turban to the Muslim hijab, are so laden with meaning that they have been the cause of fierce political struggles and even bloodshed. Food, too, can be loaded with spiritual significance far beyond its nutritional value, be it Easter eggs that symbolize new life and Christ's resurrection, or the bitter herbs and unleavened bread that Jews eat at Passover to remember their slavery in Egypt and their miraculous escape. There is hardly a dish in the world that hasn't been interpreted to symbolize something. On New Year's Day, Jews eat honey so that the coming year will be sweet. They eat fish heads so that they will be fruitful like fish and will move forward rather than back. And they eat pomegranates so that their good deeds will multiply like the many seeds of the pomegranate. Similar rituals have been used for political purposes. For thousands of years, crowns, thrones, and staffs represented kingdoms and entire empires, and millions of people died in brutal wars waged over the possession of the throne or the crown. Royal courts cultivated protocols that were so elaborate in nature that they matched the most intricate of religious ceremonies. In the military, discipline and ritual are inseparable, and soldiers from ancient Rome to the present day spend countless hours marching in formation, saluting superiors, and shining boots. Napoleon famously observed that he could make men sacrifice their lives for a colorful ribbon. Perhaps nobody understood the political importance of rituals better than Confucius, who saw the strict observance of rites, li, as the key to social harmony and political stability. Confucian classics such as the Book of Rites, the Rites of Zhou, and the Book of Etiquette and Rites recorded in the minutest details which ritual should be performed at which state occasion, down to the number of ritual vessels used in the ceremony, the type of musical instruments played, and the colors of the robes to be worn. Whenever China was hit by some crisis, Confucian scholars were quick to blame it on the neglect of rites, like a sergeant major who blames military defeat on slack soldiers not shining their boots. In the modern West, the Confucian obsession with rituals has often been seen as a sign of shallowness and archaism. In fact, it probably testifies to Confucius's profound and timeless appreciation of human nature. It is perhaps no coincidence that Confucian cultures, first and foremost in China, but also in neighboring Korea, Vietnam, and Japan, produced extremely long-lasting social and political structures. If you want to know the ultimate truth of life, rites and rituals are a huge obstacle. But if you are interested in social stability and harmony, as Confucius was, truth is often a liability, whereas rites and rituals are among your best allies. This principle is as relevant in the 21st century as it was in ancient China. The power of hocus-pocus is alive and well in our modern industrial world. For many people in 2018, two wooden sticks nailed together are God. A colorful poster on the wall is the revolution, and a piece of cloth flapping in the wind is the nation. You cannot see or hear France, because it exists only in your imagination. But you can certainly see the tricolor and hear La Marseillaise. By waving a colorful flag and singing an anthem, you transform the nation from an abstract story into a tangible reality. Thousands of years ago, devout Hindus sacrificed precious horses. Today they invest in producing costly flags. The national flag of India is known as the Tiranga, literally tricolor, because it consists of three stripes of saffron, white, and green. The 2002 Flag Code of India proclaims that the flag represents the hopes and aspirations of the people of India. It is the symbol of our national pride. Over the last 5 decades, several people, including members of the armed forces, have ungrudgingly laid down their lives to keep the tricolor flying in its full glory. The flag code then quotes Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, India's second president, who explained, "The saffron color denotes renunciation or disinterestedness. Our leaders must be indifferent to material gains and dedicate themselves to their work. The white in the center is light, the path of truth to guide our conduct. The green shows our relation to the soil, our relation to the plant life here on which all other life depends. The Asoka wheel in the center of the white is the wheel of the law of Dharma. Truth or satya, Dharma or virtue, ought to be the controlling principles of all those who work under this flag." In 2017, India's nationalist government hoisted one of the largest flags in the world at Attari on the Indo-Pakistan border. In a gesture calculated to impress neither renunciation nor disinterestedness, but rather Pakistani envy. That particular Tiranga was 115 feet long and 78 feet wide, and was hoisted on a 360-foot high flagpole. What would Freud have said about that? The flag could be seen as far as the Pakistani metropolis of Lahore. Unfortunately, strong winds kept tearing the flag, and national pride required that it be stitched together again and again, at great cost to Indian taxpayers. Why does the Indian government invest scarce resources in weaving enormous flags instead of building sewage systems in Delhi's slums? Because the flag makes India real in a way that sewage systems do not. Indeed, the very cost of the flag makes the ritual more effective. Of all rituals, sacrifice is the most potent, because of all the things in the world, suffering is the most real. You can never ignore it or doubt it. If you want to make people really believe in some fiction, entice them to make a sacrifice on its behalf. Once you suffer for a story, it is usually enough to convince you that the story is real. If you fast because God commanded you to do so, the tangible feeling of hunger makes God present more than any statue or icon. If you lose your legs in a patriotic war, your stumps and wheelchair make the nation more real than any poem or anthem. On a less grandiose level, by preferring to buy inferior local pasta to imported high-quality Italian pasta, you might make a small daily sacrifice that makes the nation feel real even in the supermarket. This is, of course, a logical fallacy. If you suffer because of your belief in God or in the nation, that does not prove that your beliefs are true. Maybe you are just paying the price of your gullibility. However, most people don't like to admit that they are fools. Consequently, the more they sacrifice for a particular belief, the stronger their faith becomes. This is the mysterious alchemy of sacrifice. In order to bring us under his power, the sacrificing priest need not give us anything at all, not rain or money or victory in war. Rather, he needs to take away something. Once he convinces us to make some painful sacrifice, we are trapped. It works in the commercial world, too. If you buy a second-hand Fiat for $2,000, you are likely to complain about it to anyone willing to listen to you. But if you buy a brand-new Ferrari for $200,000, you will sing its praises far and wide, not because it is such a good car, but because you have paid so much money for it that you have to believe it is the most wonderful thing in the world. Even in romance, any aspiring Romeo or Werther knows that without sacrifice there is no true love. The sacrifice is not just a way to convince your lover that you are serious. It is also a way to convince yourself that you are really in love. Why do you think women ask their lovers for diamond rings? Once the lover makes such a huge financial sacrifice, he must convince himself that it was for a worthy cause. Self-sacrifice is extremely persuasive, not just for the martyrs themselves, but also for their bystanders. Few gods, nations, or revolutions can sustain themselves without martyrs. If you presume to question the divine drama, the nationalist myth, or the revolutionary saga, you are immediately chastised. But the blessed martyrs died for this. Do you dare say that they died for nothing? Do you think these heroes were fools? For Shiite Muslims, the drama of the cosmos reached its climactic moment on the day of Ashura, which was the 10th day of the month of Muharram, 61 years after the Hijrah, October the 10th, 680, according to the Christian calendar. On that day, at Karbala in Iraq, soldiers of the evil usurper Yazid massacred Hussein ibn Ali, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, along with a small group of followers. For Shiites, Hussein's martyrdom has come to symbolize the eternal struggle of good against evil and of the oppressed against injustice. Just as Christians repeatedly reenact the drama of the crucifixion and imitate the passion of Christ, so Shiites reenact the drama of Ashura and imitate the passion of Hussein. Millions of Shiites flock yearly to the holy shrine in Karbala, established where Hussein was martyred, and on the day of Ashura, Shiites throughout the world stage mourning rituals, in some cases flagellating themselves with chains and cutting themselves with knives. Yet the importance of Ashura is not limited to one place and one day. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini and numerous other Shiite leaders have repeatedly told their followers that every day is Ashura and every place is Karbala. The martyrdom of Hussein at Karbala in this way gives meaning to every event, anywhere, anytime, and even the most mundane decisions are seen as having an impact on the great cosmic struggle between good and evil. If you dare doubt this story, you will immediately be reminded of Karbala, and to doubt or mock the martyrdom of Hussein is just about the worst offense you can possibly commit. Alternatively, if martyrs are scarce and people are unwilling to sacrifice themselves, the sacrificing priest might get them to sacrifice somebody else instead. You might sacrifice a human to the vengeful god Baal, burn a heretic at the stake for the greater glory of Jesus Christ, execute adulterous women because Allah said so, or send class enemies to the gulag. Once you do this, a slightly different alchemy of sacrifice begins to work its magic on you. When you inflict suffering on yourself in the name of some story, it gives you a choice. Either the story is true, or I am a gullible fool. When you inflict suffering on others, you are also given a choice. Either the story is true, or I am a cruel villain. And, just as we don't want to admit we are fools, we also don't want to admit we are villains. We prefer to believe that the story is true. In March 1839, in the Iranian city of Mashhad, a Jewish woman who suffered from some skin disease was told by a local quack that if she killed a dog and washed her hands in its blood, she would be cured. Mashhad is a holy Shiite city, and so it happened that the woman undertook the grisly therapy on the sacred day of Ashura. She was observed by some Shiites who believed, or claimed to believe, that the woman killed the dog in mockery of the Karbala martyrdom. Word of this unthinkable sacrilege quickly spread through the streets of Mashhad. Egged on by the local imam, an angry mob stormed the Jewish quarter, torched the synagogue, and murdered 36 Jews on the spot. All the surviving Jews of Mashhad were then given a stark choice: convert to Islam immediately or be killed. The sordid episode did no harm to Mashhad's reputation as Iran's spiritual capital. When we think of human sacrifice, we usually have in mind gruesome rituals in Canaanite or Aztec temples, and it is common to argue that monotheism brought an end to this terrible practice. In fact, monotheists practiced human sacrifice on a much larger scale than most polytheistic cults. Christianity and Islam have killed far more people in the name of God than did the followers of Baal or Huitzilopochtli. At a time when the Spanish conquistadors put an end to human sacrifices to the Aztec and Inca gods, back home in Spain, the Inquisition was burning heretics by the cartload. Sacrifices can come in all shapes and sizes. They don't always involve knife-wielding priests or bloody pogroms. Judaism, for example, forbids working or traveling on the holy day of Sabbath. The literal meaning of the word Sabbath is to stand still or to rest. The Sabbath starts at sunset on Friday and lasts until sunset on Saturday, and in between, Orthodox Jews refrain from almost any kind of work, including even tearing toilet paper from a roll in the lavatory. There has been some discussion of this among the most learned rabbis, who concluded that tearing toilet paper would break the Sabbath taboo. Consequently, devout Jews who want to wipe their bottoms on the Sabbath have to prepare a stash of pre-torn toilet paper in advance. In Israel, religious Jews often try to force secular Jews, and even complete atheists, to keep these taboos. Since Orthodox parties usually hold the balance of power in Israeli politics, over the years they have succeeded in passing many laws that banned all kinds of activities on the Sabbath. Though they were unable to outlaw the use of private vehicles on the Sabbath, they have been successful in banning public transportation. This nationwide religious sacrifice affects mainly the weakest sectors of society, especially as Saturday is the only day of the week when working-class people are free to travel and visit distant relatives, friends, and tourist attractions. A rich grandmother has no problem driving to visit her grandchildren in another town, but a poor grandmother who has no car cannot visit her grandchildren because there are no buses or trains running on the Sabbath. By inflicting such difficulties on hundreds of thousands of citizens, the religious parties confirm and establish their unwavering faith in Judaism. Though no blood is shed, the well-being of many people is still being sacrificed. If Judaism is just a fictional story, then it is cruel and heartless to prevent a grandmother from visiting her grandchildren, or an impoverished student from going to the beach to have some fun. By nevertheless doing so, the religious parties tell the world and themselves that they really believe in the Jewish story. What, do you think they enjoy harming people for no good reason whatsoever? Sacrifice not only strengthens your faith in the story, but also often substitutes for all your other obligations toward it. Most of the great stories of humankind have set up ideals that most people cannot fulfill. How many Christians really follow the Ten Commandments to the letter, never lying or coveting? How many Buddhists have reached the stage of egolessness? How many socialists work to the utmost of their ability while taking no more than they really need? Unable to live up to the ideal, people turn to sacrifice as a solution. A Hindu may engage in tax fraud, visit the occasional prostitute, and mistreat his elderly parents, but he convinces himself that he is a very pious person because he supports the destruction of the Babri Mosque at Ayodhya and has even donated money to build a Hindu temple in its stead. Just as in ancient times, so also in the 21st century, the human quest for meaning all too often ends with a succession of sacrifices. The Identity Portfolio. The ancient Egyptians, Canaanites, and Greeks hedged their bets when it came to sacrifices. They had many gods, and if one failed, they hoped that another would still come through. So they sacrificed to the sun god in the morning, to the earth goddess at noon, and to a mixed lot of fairies and demons in the evening. That, too, hasn't changed much. All the stories and gods in which people believe today, be they Yahweh, Mammon, the nation, or the revolution, are incomplete, full of holes, and riddled with contradictions. Therefore, people rarely put their entire faith in a single story. Instead, they keep a portfolio of several stories and several identities, switching from one to the other as the need arises. Such cognitive dissonances are inherent in almost all societies and movements. Consider a typical Tea Party supporter who somehow squares ardent faith in Jesus Christ with firm objection to government welfare policies and staunch support for the National Rifle Association. Wasn't Jesus' message focused on helping the poor rather than arming yourself to the teeth? The viewpoints might seem incompatible, but the human brain has a lot of drawers and compartments, and some neurons just don't talk to one another. Similarly, you can find plenty of Bernie Sanders supporters who have a vague belief in some future revolution, while also believing in the importance of investing their money wisely. They can easily switch from discussing the unjust distribution of wealth in the world to talking about the performance of their Wall Street portfolios. Hardly anyone has just one identity. Nobody is just a Muslim, or just an Italian, or just a capitalist. But every now and then, a fanatical creed comes along and insists that people should believe in only one story and have only one identity. In recent generations, the most fanatical such creed was fascism. Fascism insisted that people should not believe any story except the nationalist story, and should have no identity except their national identity. Not all nationalists are fascists. Most nationalists have great faith in the story of their nation, and emphasize its unique merits and the unique obligations they have toward it. But they nevertheless acknowledge that there is more to the world than just their nation. I can be a loyal Italian with special obligations toward the Italian nation and still have other identities. I can also be a socialist, a Catholic, a husband, a father, a scientist, and a vegetarian, and each of these identities entails additional obligations. Sometimes several of my identities pull me in different directions, and some of my obligations come into conflict with one another. But who said life was easy? Fascism is what happens when nationalism wants to make life too easy for itself by denying all other identities and obligations. There has been a lot of confusion lately about the exact meaning of fascism. People call almost anyone they don't like a fascist. The term is in danger of degenerating into an all-purpose term of abuse. So, what does it really mean? In brief, while nationalism teaches me that my nation is unique, and that I have special obligations toward it, fascism says that my nation is supreme, and that I owe my nation exclusive obligations. I should never prefer the interests of any group or individual over the interests of my nation, no matter what the circumstances are. Even if my nation stands to make but a paltry profit from inflicting much misery on millions of strangers in a far-off land, I should have no qualms about supporting my nation. Otherwise, I am a despicable traitor. If my nation demands that I kill millions of people, I should kill millions. If my nation demands that I betray truth and beauty, I should betray truth and beauty. How does a fascist evaluate art? How does a fascist know whether a movie is a good movie? Very simple. There is just one yardstick. If the movie serves the national interests, it is a good movie. If the movie does not serve the national interests, it is a bad movie. And how does a fascist decide what to teach kids in school? He uses the same yardstick. Teach the kids whatever serves the interests of the nation. The truth does not matter. This worship of the nation is extremely attractive, not only because it simplifies many difficult dilemmas, but also because it causes people to think that they belong to the most important and most beautiful thing in the world, their nation. The horrors of the Second World War and the Holocaust indicate the terrible consequences of this line of thinking. Unfortunately, when people talk of the ills of fascism, they often do a poor job, because they tend to depict fascism as a hideous monster, while failing to explain what is so seductive about it. This is why people today sometimes adopt fascist ideas without realizing it. People think, "I was taught that fascism is ugly, and when I look in the mirror I see something very beautiful, so I cannot be a fascist." It is a bit like the mistake Hollywood movies make when they depict the bad guys, Voldemort, Lord Sauron, Darth Vader, as ugly and mean. They are usually cruel and nasty even to their most loyal supporters. What I never understand when watching such movies is why anyone would be tempted to follow a disgusting creep like Voldemort. The problem with evil is that in real life it is not necessarily ugly. It can look very beautiful. Christianity knew this better than Hollywood, which is why traditional Christian art tended to depict Satan as a gorgeous hunk. That is why it is so difficult to resist Satan's temptations. That is also why it is difficult to deal with fascism. When you look in the fascist mirror, what you see there isn't ugly at all. When Germans looked in the fascist mirror in the 1930s, they saw Germany as the most beautiful thing in the world. If today Russians look in the fascist mirror, they will see Russia as the most beautiful thing in the world. And if Israelis look in the fascist mirror, they will see Israel as the most beautiful thing in the world. They will then want to lose themselves inside that beautiful collective. The word fascism comes from the Latin fascis, meaning a bundle of rods. That sounds like a rather unglamorous symbol for one of the most ferocious and deadly ideologies in world history. But it has a deep and sinister meaning. A single rod is very weak, and you can easily snap it in two. However, once you bundle many rods together into a fascis, it becomes almost impossible to break them. This implies that the individual is a thing of no consequence, but as long as the collective sticks together, it is very powerful. Fascists therefore believe in privileging the interests of the collective over those of any individual, and demand that no single rod ever dare break the unity of the bundle. Of course, it is never clear where one human bundle of rods ends and another begins. Why should I view Italy as the bundle of rods to which I belong? Why not my family, or the city of Florence, or the province of Tuscany, or the continent of Europe, or the entire human species? The milder forms of nationalism will tell me that I can indeed have obligations toward my family, Florence, Europe, and the whole of humankind, as well as having special obligations to Italy. In contrast, Italian fascists demand absolute loyalty to Italy alone. Despite the best efforts of Mussolini and his fascist party, most Italians remained rather lukewarm about putting Italy before their familia. In Germany, the Nazi propaganda machine did a much more thorough job, but even Hitler didn't manage to make people forget all their alternative stories. Even in the darkest days of the Nazi era, people held on to some backup stories in addition to the official one. This became patently clear in 1945. You might have thought that after 12 years of Nazi brainwashing, many Germans would be utterly incapable of making sense of their post-war lives. They had put all their faith in one great story. What to do when that story exploded? Yet most Germans recovered with amazing speed. Somewhere in their minds, they maintained other stories about the world, and no sooner had Hitler shot a bullet through his brain than people in Berlin, Hamburg, and Munich adopted new identities and found new meaning in their lives. True, about 20% of the Nazi Gauleiters, the regional party leaders, committed suicide, as did about 10% of the generals. But that means that 80% of the Gauleiters and 90% of the generals were quite happy to continue living. The vast majority of card-carrying Nazis, and even rank-and-file SS members, neither went insane nor killed themselves. They went on to become productive farmers, teachers, doctors, and insurance agents. Yet even suicide doesn't prove an absolute commitment to a single story. On November the 13th, 2015, the Islamic State orchestrated several suicide attacks in Paris that killed 130 people. The extremist group explained that it did so in order to take revenge for the French Air Force's bombing of Islamic State activists in Syria and Iraq, and in the hope that France would be deterred from carrying out such bombardments in the future. In the same breath, the Islamic State also declared that all the Muslims killed by the French Air Force were martyrs, who now enjoyed eternal bliss in heaven. Something here doesn't make sense. If the martyrs killed by the French Air Force are indeed now in heaven, why should anyone seek revenge for their deaths? Revenge for what, exactly? For sending people to heaven? If you've just learned that your beloved brother won $1 million in the lottery, would you start blowing up lottery outlets in revenge? So why go rampaging in Paris just because the French Air Force gave a few of your brothers a one-way ticket to paradise? It would be even worse if you did manage to deter the French from carrying out further bombings in Syria, for in that case fewer Muslims would get to heaven. We might be tempted to conclude that Islamic State activists don't really believe that martyrs go to heaven. That's why they are angry when they are bombed and killed. But if so, why do some of them strap on explosive belts and willingly blow themselves to smithereens? In all likelihood, the answer is that they hold on to two contradictory stories without thinking too much about the inconsistencies. As noted earlier, some neurons are just not on speaking terms with one another. 8 centuries before the French Air Force bombed Islamic State strongholds in Syria and Iraq, another French army invaded the Middle East in what is known to posterity as the Seventh Crusade. Led by the saintly King Louis IX, the Crusaders hoped to conquer the Nile Valley and turn Egypt into a Christian bulwark. However, they were defeated at the Battle of Mansoura, and most of the Crusaders were taken captive. A Crusader knight, Jean de Joinville, later wrote in his memoirs that when the battle was lost and they decided to surrender, one of his men said, "I cannot agree with this decision. What I advise is that we should all let ourselves be slain, for thus we shall go to paradise." Joinville comments dryly that none of us heeded his advice. Joinville does not explain why they refused. After all, these were men who had left their comfortable chateau in France for a long and perilous adventure in the Middle East, largely because they believed in the promise of eternal salvation. Why then, when they were but a moment away from the everlasting bliss of paradise, did they prefer Muslim captivity instead? Apparently, though the Crusaders fervently believed in salvation and paradise, at the moment of truth, they opted to hedge their bets. The supermarket at Elsinore. Throughout history, almost all humans believed in several stories at the same time, and were never absolutely convinced of the truth of any one of them. This uncertainty rattled most religions, which therefore considered faith to be a cardinal virtue, and doubt to be among the worst sins possible, as if there were something intrinsically good about believing things without evidence. With the rise of modern culture, however, the tables were turned. Faith began to look increasingly like mental slavery, while doubt came to be seen as a precondition for freedom. Sometime between 1599 and 1602, William Shakespeare wrote his version of The Lion King, better known as Hamlet. Yet, unlike Simba, Hamlet doesn't complete the circle of life. He remains skeptical and ambivalent to the very end, never discovering what life is all about, and never making up his mind whether it is better to be or not to be. In this, Hamlet is the paradigmatic modern hero. Modernity didn't reject the plethora of stories it inherited from the past. Instead, it opened a supermarket for them. The modern human is free to sample them all, choosing and combining whatever fits his or her taste. Some people cannot stand so much freedom and uncertainty. Modern totalitarian movements, such as fascism, reacted violently to the supermarket of doubtful ideas, and outdid even traditional religions in demanding absolute faith in a single story. Most modern people, however, took a liking to the supermarket. What do you do when you don't know what life is all about and which story to believe? You sanctify the very ability to choose. You stand in the supermarket aisle, with the power and freedom to choose whatever you like, examining the products laid out before you, and... freeze that frame. Cut. The end. Run the credits. According to liberal mythology, if you spend a long enough time in that big supermarket, sooner or later you'll experience the liberal epiphany and realize the true meaning of life. All the stories on the supermarket shelves are fakes. The meaning of life isn't a ready-made product. There is no divine script, and nothing outside me can give meaning to my life. It is I who imbue everything with meaning through my free choices and through my own feelings. In the fantasy film Willow, a run-of-the-mill George Lucas fairy tale, the eponymous hero is an ordinary dwarf who dreams of becoming a great sorcerer and mastering the secrets of existence. One day, such a sorcerer passes through the dwarf village in search of an apprentice. Willow and two other hopeful dwarves present themselves, and the sorcerer gives the aspirants a simple test. He extends his right hand, spreads his fingers, and asks in a Yoda-like voice, "The power to control the world is in which finger?" Each of the three dwarves picks a finger, but they all pick the wrong one. Nevertheless, the sorcerer notices something about Willow and later asks him, "When I held up my fingers, what was your first impulse?" Says Willow in embarrassment, "Well, it was stupid. To pick my own finger." "Aha!" the sorcerer exclaims in triumph. "That was the correct answer. You lack faith in yourself." Liberal mythology never tires of repeating this lesson. It is our own human fingers that wrote the Bible, the Quran, and the Vedas, and it is our minds that give these stories power. They are, no doubt, beautiful stories, but their beauty is strictly in the eyes of the beholder. Jerusalem, Mecca, Varanasi, and Bodh Gaya are sacred places, but only because of the feelings humans experience when they go there. In itself, the universe is only a meaningless hodgepodge of atoms. Nothing is inherently beautiful, sacred, or sexy. Human feelings make it so. It is only human feelings that make a red apple seductive and a piece of turd disgusting. Take away human feelings, and you are left with a bunch of molecules. We hope to find meaning by fitting ourselves into some ready-made story about the universe. But, according to the liberal interpretation of the world, the truth is exactly the opposite. The universe does not give me meaning. I give meaning to the universe. This is my cosmic vocation. I have no fixed destiny or dharma. If I find myself in Simba's or Arjuna's shoes, I can choose to fight for the crown of a kingdom, but I don't have to. I can just as well join a wandering circus, go to Broadway to sing in a musical, or move to Silicon Valley to launch a startup. I am free to create my own dharma. Like all cosmic stories, the liberal story too starts with a creation narrative. It says that the creation occurs every moment, and that I am the creator. What then is the aim of my life? To create meaning by feeling, by thinking, by desiring, and by inventing. Anything that limits the human liberty to feel, think, desire, and invent limits the meaning of the universe. Therefore, liberty from such limitations is the supreme ideal. In practical terms, those who believe in the liberal story live by the light of two commandments, create and fight for liberty. Creativity can manifest itself in writing a poem, exploring your sexuality, inventing a new app, or discovering a previously unknown chemical. Fighting for liberty includes anything that frees people from social, biological, or physical constraints, be it demonstrating against brutal dictators, teaching girls to read, finding a cure for cancer, or building a spaceship. The liberal pantheon of heroes houses Rosa Parks and Pablo Picasso alongside Louis Pasteur and the Wright brothers. This sounds extremely exciting and profound in theory. Unfortunately, human freedom and human creativity are not what the liberal story imagines them to be. To the best of our scientific understanding, there is no magic behind our choices and creations. They are the product of billions of neurons exchanging biochemical signals, and even if you liberate humans from the yoke of the Catholic Church and the Soviet Union, their choices will still be dictated by biochemical algorithms as ruthless as the Inquisition and the KGB. The liberal story instructs me to seek freedom, to express and realize myself. But both the self and freedom are mythological chimeras borrowed from the fairy tales of ancient times. Liberalism has a particularly confused notion of free will. Humans obviously have a will, they have desires, and they are sometimes free to fulfill their desires. If by free will you mean the freedom to do what you desire, then yes, humans have free will. But if by free will you mean the freedom to choose what to desire, then no, humans have no free will. If I am sexually attracted to men, I may be free to realize my fantasies, but I am not free to feel an attraction to women instead. In some cases, I might decide to restrain my sexual urges, or even try sexual conversion therapy. But the very desire to change my sexual orientation is something forced upon me by my neurons, egged on perhaps by cultural and religious biases. Why does one person feel ashamed of his sexuality and strive to alter it, while another person celebrates the same sexual desires without a trace of guilt? You can say that the former might have stronger religious feelings than the latter. But do people freely choose whether to have strong or weak religious feelings? Again, a person might decide to go to church every Sunday in a conscious effort to strengthen his weak religious feelings. But why does one person aspire to be more religious, while another is perfectly happy to remain an atheist? This may result from any number of cultural and genetic dispositions, but it is never the result of free will. What's true of sexual desire is true of all desire, and indeed of all feelings and thoughts. Just consider the next thought that pops into your mind. Where did it come from? Did you freely choose to think it? And only then did you think it? Certainly not. The process of self-exploration begins with simple things and becomes progressively harder. At first, we realize that we do not control the world outside us. I don't decide when it rains. Then we realize that we do not control what's happening inside our own body. I don't control my blood pressure. Next, we understand that we don't even govern our brain. I don't tell the neurons when to fire. That's more difficult. Ultimately, we should realize that we do not control our desires, or even our reactions to these desires. Realizing this can help us become less obsessive about our opinions, about our feelings, and about our desires. We don't have free will, but we can be a bit more free from the tyranny of our will. Humans usually place so much importance on their desires that they try to control and shape the entire world according to these desires. In pursuit of their cravings, humans fly to the moon, wage world wars, and destabilize the entire ecosystem. If we understand that our desires are not the magical manifestations of free choice, but are rather the product of biochemical processes, influenced by cultural factors that are also beyond our control, we might be less preoccupied with them. It is better to understand ourselves, our minds, and our desires, than to try to realize whatever fantasy pops into our heads. And in order to understand ourselves, a crucial step is to acknowledge that the self is a fictional story that the intricate mechanisms of our mind constantly manufacture, update, and rewrite. There is a storyteller in my mind that explains who I am, where I come from, where I am heading, and what is happening to me right now. Like the government spin doctors who explain the latest political upheavals, my inner narrator repeatedly gets things wrong, but rarely, if ever, admits it. And just as the government builds a national myth with flags, icons, and parades, so my inner propaganda machine creates a personal myth with prized memories and cherished traumas that often bear little resemblance to the truth. In the age of Facebook and Instagram, you can observe this myth-making process more clearly than ever before, because some of it has been outsourced from the mind to the computer. It is fascinating and terrifying to behold people spending countless hours constructing and embellishing a perfect self online, becoming attached to their own creation and mistaking it for the truth about themselves. That's how a family holiday fraught with traffic jams